This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On this week's episode, we have three segments for you. We're going to begin with Margaret Freeman, who's going to tell us about the winter education programs. And then Sam Barish, the former president of the USDF, will be here to tell us what it means to him to have won the 2016 Lifetime Achievement Award. And later on in our education segment, we begin a new two-part series on strategic planning for riders. But first, as always, a reminder that the views of guests and the host of this official USDF podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the USDF or its members. We have just one item of news for you this week, that the USDF and the Great American Insurance Group have announced a total prize money of $180,000 that will be awarded at the 2017 Great American Insurance Group USDF Regional Championships. The prize money will be divided evenly among the 9 regions and 35 divisions that are on offer, allowing each of the regions to present competitors with over $20,000 in prize money and awards. The champions in each region and division will each receive $344 in prize money and an embroidered jacket and gift certificate provided by SmartPak, the official supplement feeding system of the USDF. Reserve champions in each region and division will receive $229 in prize money, along with a saddle pad provided by the Great American Insurance Group, the title sponsor of the championships. The Great American USDF Regional Championships are presented by SmartPak and supported by Platinum Performance and Merrill. And you'll find more information about these championships on the USDF website at usdf.org, or you can contact the USDF office at regchamps@usdf.org, regchamps at usdf.org. And now for our first segment this week. Margaret Freeman is a USEF senior dressage judge and USDF executive board member, and she has some advice for us on organising winter education events. Margaret, welcome back to the programme.
Thank you. I've had fun being involved with some winter education projects that are still going on really well, even though I no longer live in the area where they are occurring. And I think so many people go to Florida, but a lot of people stay behind. And I think it depends on, number one, you've got to have maybe a live wire in your group who could set something like this up. But it also depends a lot on how many people are in the area. If you've got a really spread out group, it might be tougher. The most successful one I know about was set up by London Gray, and I should warn anybody, if you sit down close to London Gray, she'll grab onto you, and you'll end up running something like a winter education program before you know it. But she has this program in Connecticut that has been going on now for, I think, 15 years. And it's a whole weekend, speakers all day Saturday and Sunday, very reasonably priced, includes lunch. And a core group from her Dressage for Kids organization runs it. But one of the reasons it works really well is because we do it at a regional high school. So the regional high school has an equestrian program, which helps because they contribute, but it's all free because it's at the high school. We don't have to pay anything. The other thing that's really cool about it is because it's at a high school, they have all kinds of AV equipment available. All the classrooms have AV equipment. The auditorium has AV equipment. If you go to a hotel, which is fine, you have to pay for all that stuff. So that helps us keep the costs down. But we get, this program is at the end of January, early February. We get 300 people at this every year, and it's been going on, like I said, for more than a decade. And that is called it's now the Weekend Equestrian Program up in Southbury, Connecticut. Another program I was involved with was actually a judge forum in New Jersey, and a couple of the judges decided that it would just be useful to get together on a Sunday and just sort of do some cross-pollinization, some looking at videos, just to kind of keep our brains percolating over the winter. And that evolved very quickly into an annual thing where we had 25, 30 people come every year, and they still are. I don't live there anymore. I'm now in North Carolina, but they're still very active. It's at a person's home. It's potluck, so it costs nothing. And they now apply for university credit and with USDF, and that also is the possibility maybe down the line of a continuing education program for judges. One thing that has worked very well for a winter education program but is only every 4 years is a new test clinic. So every time the new dressage test come out, which is on December 1st every 4 years, it's just the opportunity is ripe for winter educational programs, and you get a judge or somebody who's an expert on the test to lead discussions, perhaps present a program of some kind. And I've done this a lot, so every 4 years I end up actually flying around quite a bit to lead some of these. But again, it's not outrageously expensive, especially if you use somebody local. I feel very gratified that people are happy to bring me in, but of course it'd be less expensive if you have a leader who's local. I did one in Pennsylvania when the new test came out 2 years ago, where they made it a weekend. They had a Friday program just for judges, and then they had a Saturday program of all the new tests, and then they had a Sunday program that was on showmanship. And they held it at New Bolton Center, so they were able to rent a room there that had AV equipment. But it's very centrally located, and it was a lot of fun for the whole weekend. Another winter program I did once was actually almost a camp. They held it overnight. They had a clinic in a ring with horses on the first day. And then everybody, I guess, took their horses home. And then we were at one person's facility who had lots of camp space. And we all stayed overnight, and we talked about the new tests and then talked about the new tests again on Sunday. It was really a lot of fun. And, you know, it just depends on who has something like that available. But I think that, you know, for those of us who don't go to Florida or California or Arizona, it's just a lot of fun to keep getting together two or three times over the winter, maybe once a week on a Wednesday night. I live in Tryon, North Carolina. There's a group here that does that. They just get a local speaker, a veterinarian, a feed specialist, a tack specialist to come and do a talk, and they do it at the local, it's actually a rebuilt train station. They don't have to pay any rent. I've noticed firehouses around here anyway, the fire departments all have rooms, social rooms that are available without that you don't have to pay rent. So, and the libraries, local libraries, usually have a room that you can get that don't require rent. I think the key very often is whether they have AV equipment, because if we're dressage people, we don't want to just talk, we want to watch horses. But I think you're going to have people a lot more excited about showing in the spring and doing things in the spring, other activities, if they can keep on sort of their brains percolating through the winter. Now, for the eventers involved, you know, the USCF, they're on a four-year cycle with their new tests, but so are the inventors. And our new tests are going to come out, the dressage new tests are going to come out in 2 years, but the inventors' new tests are going to come out next year. So those people who might hear this who do the eventing tests might want to think about having their own new test clinic early next year. And the $600 question would be getting a hold of videos, which that's possible because there are people who film the test. And, you know, if you can plan that ahead, then that's really cool. But the USDF on the levels video, which is available both, I'm sorry, not as video, it's a CD, but it's also available online. So if you can get AV equipment that can project it from a computer or from a DVD, you're golden. Every time I've done one of those new test clinic, and even I've done clinics in the winter where, you know, in between the four-year cycle, it just gets people talking. It gets their brains excited about what's coming up, and I think it helps. It's just fun, but it also helps direct the training a little bit. For those who would like to do a program like this, it is very individual. It depends on how many numbers you have in your area. The judge forum I was talking about, where I was in New Jersey, we had something like 30 judges within an hour radius. So it made having a judge forum sort of a no-brainer. It would depend, you know, how close people are. I think weeknights sometimes are better than weekends, even in the winter. People are busy. There's one thing I think that would help get a program like this started. It would be, as I mentioned before, the On the Levels video that the USDF has, because you can do it yourself. You can turn off the sound and just do the discussion yourself, or you can watch it with the commentary that comes with it and then stop it and have a discussion over that. You can do it by level. You can do it intro level. You can do it upper levels. But I think if you want to get a program like this started, or at least try one evening this winter, using the On the Level DVD would be a great idea. And then see if that perks people's interest, then you can come up with another idea. And, of course, potluck, you know, helps and makes the evening very nice.
Always helps when there's food involved, doesn't it?
Always helps when there's food involved.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for that, Margaret. Appreciate you taking the time to come on the program. Thank you.
Thank you.
And as always, you can find more information on the website at usdf.org. There's a list of the currently approved dressage-specific education programs on the Education Programs and Events calendar. Dr. Sam Barish joins me now. First of all, welcome to the program and congratulations, Sam, on winning the Lifetime Achievement Award.
Chris, thank you very much.
In such a distinguished career that you've had, Sam, what does this one particularly mean to you?
Well, I spent 35 years working in dressage, and this recognition from the Lifetime Achievement Award from USDF is one of the highlights of my life. It's a very significant achievement, and I'm very, very pleased that I was honored in this way.
Many of our listeners will remember you as the president, of course, of the USDF, but this all began for you not so much as a rider or an owner back in the 80s, but actually as an announcer, which is a different way to come into the sport. And of course, the horse husband that became addicted to the sport, thanks to your wife.
Yes, I started in dressage in the 1970s. And my ex-wife, Ruth Barish, was in eventing and dressage. And I wanted to be with her when she was involved in these activities, so I kept coming to them, and I thought, well, if I am going to be there, I might as well do something of value if I'm going to spend all my time there. So I started scoring at dressage shows, and then I started organizing schooling shows, and 1977 became the second president of the Western Pennsylvania Dressage Association. And I was organizing clinics and schooling shows in Western Pennsylvania, in the Pittsburgh area, to popularize it. And then in 1980, when I came to Maryland, then I became involved in the Potomac Valley Dressage Association very heavily.
Did you have any interest or involvement with horses prior to that, Sam?
None whatsoever.
What was it about the administration and the organization that appealed to you? Is it just that you felt that you could bring your skills to this to be a part of the sport?
Yes, I would say that from the beginning, I still have great respect for how difficult dressage is to do for a rider, a trainer, and an instructor. When it's done very well, it looks very easy. But as dressage people know, it's extremely difficult. So I appreciated that, and I also like to watch the rise. Even a training level test, when it's done extremely well, I was very pleased in enjoying it. Also, as far as my ability is concerned, I thought that with my organizational skills, I could make a difference in the dressage world, and my 35 years of working in it gave me that opportunity.
What was it about the officiating side of it that you enjoyed so much, Sam?
Well, again, it's an opportunity to be involved and have a voice and a role in sport dressage. And I also enjoyed the rules, because I was a technical delegate for 25 years. And actually, what I've used my experience as a technical delegate in dressage and my 40 years of playing tennis. About 3 years ago, I became a licensed official for the United States Tennis Association and the Intercollegiate Tennis Association. So the combination of my tennis experience in playing and my dressage technical delegate experience led to this USTA officiating, which I am really enjoying. And also the announcing was something of great interest to me, because when I was a young boy, I was in plays at camp and in school. I was in seven plays. I played the lead in every single one I was in. So that gave way to announcing at dressage shows, which I am still doing. I've been doing that for over 35 years, and I really enjoy that as well.
And when you look back at your involvement in setting up these organizations, being part of the organizations across the sport, talk about some of the people that inspired you at that time, Sam, that you worked with in those early days.
I would say Lowell Boomer, when I became involved in USDF, was an inspiration, that he could put everything together and have support all over the country for founding USDF. I had great respect for that. I also had quite a degree of admiration for David O'Connor. After he left competing, what he was able to do with the United States Equestrian Federation, because I worked with him as well. Another person was Alan Balch, who I thought was the president of AHSA and the USA Equestrian after that. Even though, you know, he was a controversial figure, he was an extremely intelligent man, and I was impressed by his skills. And another very good friend of mine, Colonel Clarence Edmonds, is also a USDF Lifetime Achievement Award winner, was an inspiration to me.
When you look back in the rearview mirror, Sam, at those very early days and what dressage needed, what did you feel that you could bring about in terms of change and improvement in the sport? What did it most need at that time, in those very early days in the 80s, for example?
Well, in the 1980s, when I first became involved in the Potomac Valley Dressage Association in Rockville, Maryland, I noticed that there were a lot of dressage shows going on, but they were not really leading anywhere except for the AHSA regional championships, which were expensive and very difficult to compete in. And I thought that there were so many shows, there weren't enough championships. So in 1983, I founded the Colonel Bank Youngquist Memorial Championships, which were very simple to compete in, very inexpensive. And that's a dressage championship series that has gone on now for 34 years and it has been very successful. I also thought that what I could add is someone who did not really have an axe to grind and a conflict with being involved in the sport. I was neither a rider, a trainer, an owner, or an instructor. I was just someone who was interested in trying to improve the sport, and I thought that perspective helped me out throughout my career as president of the Potomac Valley Dressage Association and also chairman of the board, and later on Region 1 director, vice president, and president of USDF.
Well, you, of course, with your various roles as director and president and vice president and, of course, USDF president from 2000 until 2009, you've had both the short and the long view of the sport, Sam. So when you reflect on that now, how do you see how the sport has grown and what it's achieved, if you look at the big picture for the country, not just in competition, but education?
Well, in both education and competition, the United States has made enormous strides over the past 40 years. Education, USDF has been prime in that, in particular with the L Education Program for judge training and also the Instructor Certification Program. And Young Riders Education Program, Adult Amateur Education, USDF really has been quite innovative and all-encompassing with involving adult amateurs, juniors at all levels throughout the country. As far as competition achievement is concerned, you can see that worldwide the scores in the Olympics and the World Championships get higher and higher every 2, 4, 6, 8 years as time goes on. And the United States is right there with improvement, doing extremely well in the last Olympics and also in national championships in the United States now that there is a national championship and also the U.S. Equestrian Championships. The level has risen so high over the past 40 years that we're in very good stead with all the rest of the world. And I'm just one more thing to point out is that the L Education for Judge Training Program is considered internationally as the best judge training program in the world. And USDF deserves enormous amounts of credit for producing that program and improving it over the years.
And, of course, you were influential in relocating the USDF's head office to Lexington to create the USDF National Education Center. When you look back at that and how you felt about it at the time, why that was important to the organization, Sam, how do you look at it now as to how that contributed to the growth of the organization and its educational role?
Well, on a personal level, it gives me great pride. Every time I hear about the USDF National Education Center at the Kentucky Horse Park in Lexington, and knowing how that was conceived. And to me, it was a no-brainer that in Lincoln, Nebraska, our original home from 1973 for USDF, there was very little dressage going on there. And now that we were able to have the move about 10 years ago to the Kentucky Horse Park, when we have a building that's right next door to the United States Equestrian Federation, and you know the World Equestrian Games were held there, and it's the horse capital of the United States. And to be there and to have USDF with that presence is gives me great satisfaction. And the fact that we were able to work so cooperatively and still are with U.S. Equestrian with joint programs and initiatives that have helped improve dressage greatly in the United States.
We should mention that you still hold the record for the longest tenure as a member of the executive board and so many different roles and accomplishments. When you look back at your contribution to the sport, and of course it was celebrated at the USDF Salute Gala, what are you most proud of? What would you like to consider to be your legacy?
Well, number one is the move to Lexington, and that I played an important role in. And number two was the capital campaign for the USDF National Education Center, and I had a big part in that. And I'm very pleased with the generosity of our members. And also, as I mentioned before, the USDF-US Equestrian joint programs and relationships are key. I'm very pleased with that and how that's flourished over the years since we've been at the Kentucky Horse Park. Also, Stephen Hinch, hiring him about 12 years ago as the executive director for USDF has been a major improvement in how USDF operates, and we would never have been able to attract someone of his caliber to that position if we were not located in Lexington. Also, the strategic plan that we did about 10 years ago set our course for the future and has guided us for the last decade.
Well, congratulations again, Sam, and thank you so much for your contribution to the sport and for taking time to come on the program. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I thank you for this opportunity and also USDF for giving me the opportunity to work in the sport, and particularly on the executive board for 21 years.
And our thanks again to Dr. Sam Barish for his services to the USDF and to dressage in the United States. And there'll be more information about the Roma Foundation USDF Hall of Fame Awards in the show notes accompanying this episode. And if you know of a deserving individual, please make sure to nominate them for the 2017 award. And finally, in our education segment, we have part one of a two-part series from the education session Goal Setting and Strategic Planning for Dressage Riders that was held during the 2016 Adequan USDF Annual Convention. Certified health and wellness coach Jen Verharen helps you shift your thinking, get into action, and accomplish more goals than you ever thought possible.
I want to talk a little bit before I start about what actually brings me here, how I landed here in front of you. I have had a small training and teaching business for 25 years or more. And about 7 or 8 years ago, I had a mini breakdown, burnout. And I really got to a place in my life, in my riding, in my career, where I felt really exhausted. I had been kind of in a rat wheel for a long time. And I decided to hire a coach to help me kind of figure out how to get out of that. I'd been introduced to coaching as a career when I was in graduate school, and it took me 20-odd years to get around to really investigating it further. But what I learned through my own process of getting myself out of that stuck place, I realized that as horse people, we have a lot of inherent challenges that the things that I was learning were really applicable to. And I realized that a lot of my riders could benefit from the process that I'd gone through. So I went about getting certified as a coach, and I spent 3 years in the corporate world as a coach and trainer. And then I missed my horse people, so I came back and decided to start my own business as a business and performance coach for riders. So that's what I've been doing for the last few years. One of the things that I have learned is that we as horse people have some challenges that other people don't. Whether we are trainers, whether we're adult amateurs, whether we're young riders, horses, we are very passionate. They require 24/7 care. They take a tremendous amount of time. We have tremendous highs and lows in our lives as horse people. We need to be very resilient. We need to be adaptable. And sometimes horses tend to be sort of all-consuming. It can create a lot of unbalance in our lives. When horses are out of balance, they have to use tension to stay in balance. They are not very athletic. They're not very free. It's hard to get harmony and connection. And when you have balance and your horse is in balance, all of a sudden, there's harmony, there's connection, there's freedom, there's self-expression, there's elasticity. And I really love this analogy because these are all things we want in our lives as well. So we're going to talk about strategic planning and goal setting. And there are lots of reasons why people don't set goals. One of them is a fear of failure. People talk a lot about fearing failure, but also fearing success. I like to look at this more as a fear of change. As human beings, we inherently don't like things to change. So it's a lot easier to kind of keep our eyes down and just keep plugging along than it is to look ahead and set goals. A lot of times we're not sure how to set goals. We don't really know where to start. We might be afraid that if we pick one goal, we're going to miss out on other things. It's hard sometimes to know exactly, you know, we think there's a right goal and a wrong goal. So that can stop us from setting goals. A lot of people really don't like the pressure of having a goal. They feel like that they're going to be put in a box. They lose confidence in themselves over a lifetime of setting goals and not achieving them. They lose confidence in themselves to follow through. Really want flexibility. They don't want to be boxed in. And a lot of people think that we don't need goals. And I used to be one of those people. I had all of these mindsets at one point or another in my life. So what I have come to believe and understand now, having my own experience and worked with so many people, is that there are lots of really good reasons to set goals. One of them is that we want to be stretched. We want to challenge ourselves. We want to have new experiences. We want to be able to fully utilize the gifts and talents that we have. And a big one is to live a regret-free life. When I was approaching 40, and I looked at, you know, where I was at and some of the things that I had not yet done because I was kind of afraid to set goals around them, I could lay awake at night. And I don't know how many of you have had the experience of laying awake at night and kind of thinking, oh, that other life I was supposed to live has sort of passed me by. So it's never too late to live the life that you're meant to live. Staying sharp and healthy, maximizing your investments, especially as horse people, we invest a tremendous amount in our horses and in our riding and in our education. And one of the things I find a lot with people I work with is they sacrifice so much to have their horses. and then they have to work a lot. They don't have the money. They have to do their barn work. All of these things take priority over actually riding and spending time with their horses. So it's easy for priorities to get a little bit out of balance. And when we set goals, we want to feel a particular way. Notice on this list, going to the Olympics is not up there. Having a fancy car is not up there. Buying a nice house is not up there. And the reason for that is because most of the material things we want and the achievements that we want that are our goals, they actually represent a way that we want to feel when we have those things or we have achieved those things. So this is a really important thing as we move along, is to really identify why your goals are important to you and what's the feeling that you're after in your life and how those goals are going to get you there. The probability of completing a goal increases by 10%. If you have an idea or a goal, you have 10% chance of having that goal come to fruition. If you consciously decide you will do it, 25% chance of achieving that goal. If you decide when you will do it and you put a time frame on it, 40% chance. If you plan specifically how you will do it, you have a 50% chance. If you commit to someone else that you're going to do it, you have a 65% chance. And if you have a specific accountability appointment with someone, you have a 95% chance of achieving your goal. So I think this really demonstrates the importance of the goal setting process and the strategic planning process if you really want to make your goals happen. So what we're going to do today is we're going to set a powerful goal, and then we're going to create a strategic plan and discuss ways then that this plan is actually going to help you manage adversity. And then we're going to talk about how to get in action and some of the things that stop us from getting in action. What I'd like everybody to do right now, take a piece of scratch paper and write down a goal. What's the goal that kind of bubbles to the surface for you when you think about the one goal that'll make the biggest difference for you in the next year? So when you're creating a goal, there's two components to the goal. One is the measurable result. The intention is the why. Why is this important? What is the purpose of this goal? So if you were gonna state the intention of your goal, what would it be? In the present or past tense, as if it's happening or already has happened. So your first sentence is your measurable result, and then your intention might be something like, I feel a sense of satisfaction and completion and achievement in having accomplished a goal. So that might be your second sentence. Really getting clear about the words. So language creates our world, you guys. The language is really, really important. So you want to have your goal clearly connected to things that are important to you. If your goal is not clearly connected to things that you have identified as important to you, it'll be much more likely to hit the cutting room floor or never happen. How many people have you heard say, I'm going to lose weight, I'm going to ride more, I'm going to exercise 3 days a week? And the language we use, if you use the future tense, it keeps your goals in the future. So part of the intention here is to give you an experience of having accomplished your goal. So part of the objective then is that you become that person. You start to make decisions from that place, having had that experience of saying it out loud. One of the things about goals is that they should give you a visceral response. You should be excited or a little bit scared, a little bit nervous. Otherwise, it's not worth setting the goal. If it's not important or enough outside your comfort zone to make you a little nervous, don't bother. You won't be motivated enough in the long run to make it happen. So if you don't feel a little emotional or a little scared when you say your goal, it's not a powerful goal. So some of the things that you might have noticed, I already talked about the present or past tense. I talked about the measurable result and the intention. I talked about the fact that it needs to inspire a visceral response. Meaningful descriptive language is really important. You want to make it concise, one to four sentences. And it's really important not to refer to the past or current state. So I get a lot of, I want to be a better rider, or I want to be better at sitting the trot, or I want to lose weight. All of those things are references to the past. So instead, you want to use descriptive language. If you want to sit the trot better, what is it you want to do? I want to brilliantly ride a second level test with suppleness and fluidity, or whatever it is. But what is it that's getting better is going to mean, what is actually going to happen, and then including a time reference right off the bat. And I want to say something about that, is that can change, it can be flexible. A lot of people are really resistant to putting a time frame in there, but you know, you can adapt, you can change. The fun part of this strategic planning process is that it's creative and adaptable. So the difference between strategic planning and long-term planning. Strategic planning is a process where you start with your desired result. You don't think about how. There is no planning allowed in the goal setting part of a strategic planning process, because the second you start planning, before you've identified very clearly what you want, you run into all kinds of roadblocks, emotional resistance, and all kinds of crap. So you want to start with your vision, your goal, and a really clear idea of what you want to have happen. When we do long-term planning, it's more kind of, okay, here's where I am, step by step by step, starting with where you are and moving forward. And it's not as effective of a process. So now we're going to move on to the strategy part of the plan. And we actually skipped the vision part. So there's a whole nother part of this that actually, when you have a clear vision for your life and how your goals fit into that vision, it makes the goals even more powerful. So you want to think about your intention and how it's connected to a bigger vision that you have for your life. Okay, so the strategy is the how, the goal is the what, the strategy is the how, and then the action is what you're going to do. If you have a strategy, you cannot check it off a list. It's an ongoing habit, or it's something that you do on a regular basis that helps you towards your goal. And the really great thing about strategies is they can be changed. This distinction between a goal and a strategy is so important, because if I have people say to me, okay, my goal is to work out 3 days a week, and the first day that you don't work out 3 days a week, you've basically failed. You've not accomplished your goal. And then you tell stories about how, you know, bad you are at achieving goals, and that sort of leads on to a downward spiral. So a goal really needs to be the what. If you think your goal is to work out 3 days a week, probably that goal is more like, I feel fit and healthy enough to play with my grandkids and I fit into a pair of size 5 jeans, whatever. But it's something that really creates that visceral response into you that makes you really excited. So then the strategy becomes really flexible. You can try lots of different things to get there. You don't have to give up the goal if your first strategy doesn't work. Okay, so what I'm going to have you guys do now, brainstorm. What are all the things that need to happen in order for that goal to come to fruition? Just write it all down, and then we're going to go through and identify which are strategies and which are actions. And some of them might be benchmarks. They might be smaller goals on the way to your larger goal, and that's fine too. Okay, so just take a couple of minutes to do that. Okay, now I'm going to ask you, okay, those are strategies. What is going to go on your action plan now? And so what an action plan is, a list of things that need to be done in order for your goal to be, so it's not a list of competencies, but it's a list of things that you need to do that you can check off a list, say that is done. And it's different than a to-do list, because things on your action plan are going to impact your life. They're going to make a difference towards your goal. They're going to move you forward. Things on a to-do list keep the status quo. So things on the to-do list are emails, mucking stalls, returning phone calls, you know, taking the kids to choir practice, whatever it is. Those are to-dos. An action plan is clearly things that move you towards your goal. So your strategic plan now includes a goal, it includes some strategies, and it includes an action plan.
And our thanks again to Jen Verharen. Stay tuned for the concluding part of this two-part series on strategic planning for dressage riders. That will be coming up on the next episode here of the USDF official podcast. And before we go, we want to remind you to buy your tickets for the Longines FEI World Cup Jumping and FEI World Cup Dressage Finals, which will be taking place in Omaha, Nebraska this year. Single session tickets are now on sale. The world's best horses and riders, of course, will be jumping and doing their dressage in a head-to-head battles for the coveted championship titles at the CenturyLink Center there in Omaha. And the dates for that competition are March the 29th through April the 2nd. And the official website for the World Cup Finals is omahaworldcup2017.com, where you can purchase your tickets and, of course, get much more information about the competition. And that's it for this week's episode. Be sure to check out the website for more educational resources and information at eTrack. You can find out when the latest episode of this podcast will be available by following us on social media. Just look for the official page on Facebook and also on Twitter. And just to remind you that if you're new to this podcast, as well as being able to listen on the website by clicking the link at the very top of the homepage, you can also download it from the iTunes podcast store to any podcast app. And that's it for this week. Thank you for listening wherever you are in the world. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.